Connie Kaplan, and welcome to the Invisible Garment Podcast, where we talk about spiritual principles, knitting, and the politics of ethical behavior. Today, we'll talk about the principle called innocence and the heart brain. I'll explain to you how knitters are really quantum physicists. We'll talk about how science has finally discovered innocence. And we have a special essay from a knitter, dreamer, podcast friend. Today's principle is innocence. Innocence as a spiritual principle. I think if I had been choosing the words to name these principles, I might have used a different one, like wonder or awe or astonishment. Because innocence is the principle that makes us teachable. It is the principle that keeps us interested in learning. It keeps us childlike, not childish, childlike, by constantly igniting our curiosity and our fascination with newness. Now, I have hours of things to say about innocence, and so I started fishing around in my mind for what was the most important aspect of today's discussion, and I decided that it is this. Innocence is anchored in our physical bodies, in the heart. And the heart is the brain of the 21st century. I don't know if you've had a chance to read Joseph Chilton Pierce's book, The Biology of Transcendence, but it is so brilliant because in it he talks about the idea that the heart itself, the physical organ, is becoming the new brain of our human system. We can literally think with our hearts. He explains that how, you know, if you look back over the evolution of the brain system, it started with the reptilian brain, which is the one that we call the fight or flight brain. It's just the very basic, most fundamental living aspects of our brain. And then along came the mammalian brain. And this brain introduced like new levels of understanding experience and new levels of, and of course it introduced new ways to birth our babies and to feed our babies, but new levels of nurturance between beings. And so when the mammalian brain evolved, there had to be something like a negotiation between the reptilian brain and the mammalian brain. What are you in charge of? What am I in charge of? And about the time that negotiation was settled, hundreds of thousands, millions of years, along came the neocortex. And this is the brain that makes us human. This is a brain that gives us the option between creativity and rationality and fires between those two lobes so that we can become human. We can create, we can think, we can develop, we can interreact in ways that no other creatures can on our planet. And then eventually along came the frontal lobes, which are really a part of the neocortex, if I understand it correctly, but they add another dimension. They add something like a spiritual dimension and something like the most sophisticated ways of thinking. So, of course, the neocortex and the mammalian brain and the reptilian brain all had to do their negotiation about who's in charge of what and who's dominant. And so now, Pierce suggests that another brain system is developing. It's the brain of the heart. The heart has, interestingly, almost as many direct connectors between the heart, the organ, the heart, and the nervous system as the brain does between the organ, the brain, and the nervous system. These connectors, which they call ganglia, are the ways in which the neurons, the cells that we call neurons, fire their electronic impulses and communicate with the rest of the body. And it turns out that while for centuries we thought that the heart was primarily a muscle, it turns out that about 65% of the heart cells are actually Neuron cells, they're just as sophisticated as brain cells in terms of communicating with the body. And so Pierce suggests that the heart is developing as a brain. And so that's an interesting interweaving with the principle of innocence, which is the principle that makes us want to learn. So those of us who are developing spiritually are finding that we want to learn more with our hearts. And this is not necessarily, you know, all naive and new agey. This is the heart developing a learning machine, which creates these neural networks that rewire themselves every time we have life experiences that we register, but they rewire themselves according to a much vaster body of information than the head brain works, because the heart is also a broadcasting machine. As you know, the heart creates an electromagnetic field around your body. And what scientists are learning lately is that electromagnetic fields shoot out these little things that look like wires or hairs. Electromagnetic fields are made out of these little wiry, hairy, intelligent things. And some of them are loops, as if they shoot out and then gravity at some point pulls them back. So these are communication fields that send something out and bring something back. But some of them are more like fingers or strings or hair. They just kind of shoot out and hang out there. So our heart is something that both radiates our energy out, but also feeds back to us about the energy around us. And that makes this heart brain actually a more intelligent brain than the head brain. And I'm sure that we all know that we're kind of in battle between our hearts and our heads right now. We all are. We know on one level, on one compassionate level, that we need to change our way of living on this planet. We need to change our footprint. We need to change our compassion and or lack of compassion. We need to change our financial system. We need to change our belief that anything is, quote, worth whatever we think it is worth monetarily. That's our head brain thinking. And that's our heart brain thinking. Because the head brain is still thinking, no. Hold on. You know, do the math. Be very careful about what you let go. Be very careful about being too generous. So innocence steps in. And innocence says, wait a minute, let's continue to learn. Let's continue to take in new information. Let's look further. Let's look more deeply. The spiritual principle of innocence is so beautiful. It is not a naive principle. It is not a silly little, you know, stay in the dark type principle. It is the principle that craves to learn. And now on to my favorite part of the podcast, where we're going to talk about knitting as a metaphor for innocence. Now, each principle has what I call an in-here anchor and an out-there anchor. So I've just been talking about the fact that the in-here anchor for innocence is the heart. The out-there anchor for innocence is in our collective cultural archetypes. Archetypes are like stereotypes. They're like basic patterns. And archetypes are mostly known to us through our myths and our stories and our films and our music. They are about that which is not visible, yet that which is just beyond our awareness, but which clearly exists in our reality. It's those thought systems of basic isness, creativeness, hero-ness, lover and beloved-ness, mother-ness, trickster-ness, villainess. Those are the archetypes of our culture. Those are the basic ideas and building blocks of our cultural reality. So quantum physics theory suggests that there is something more than just archetype. It is something like an umbilical cord, a string that connects through the nesses. In other words, all rocks are connected through rockness, and that string is there through all rocks. All roses are connected through roseness. Now, here's the interesting part, and this is how we know that knitters are actually quantum physicists. All sweaters are connected through sweaterness, and socks through sockness, and gloves through gloveness, and on and on and on. When we pick up our pointy sticks and our string and we start knitting, let's say a sweater, we enter into the world of sweaterness via its archetype. So when we knitters are knitting, we are living in the cultural patterning of sweaterness or whatever it is that we're knittingness. And yet we're creating a unique experience of that pattern. Knitters are by definition practitioners of innocence. Every pattern requires that you learn something new, whether you're following a pattern, making a pattern, or following a pattern that you're simultaneously, you know, changing and adjusting along the way. Every garment becomes an experience in learning. You are within an archetypal specific form, and yet something is changing about it. Something is new. Something is being learned, even by the most sophisticated of knitters who've been knitting forever. My relationship to knitting is definitely an experience of innocence. My granny taught me to knit. Now, when I tell this story, I find myself saying often that she taught me to knit when I was 3 years old. I can't imagine how that could be true. I can't imagine that at 3 years old, I was actually able to, you know, have a physical dexterity to knit. But that's what I remember, that when I was three was when I started to knit. She was a knitter. She wasn't like a great knitter. She didn't do like all kinds of fancy Farrow sweaters and multicolored garments, but she knitted a lot. And I asked her at one point if she would teach me to knit. And the next thing I knew, there were some sticks there. They were big enough for my little hands. They were probably like size 10 or 11, something like that. And she got some real bright, colorful yarn that was just the right size for my, you know, my hands and my dexterity. And she taught me to knit. And every summer when I would go and visit her after that, there would always be sticks that were my size and yarn that was my size and some color that she had picked out. And there would always be a new project there that she had in mind for me to knit. She always convinced me that those projects were useful. I have to admit that the first archetype of knitting that I entered was the hot pad for the kitchen-ness. And God knows what those hot pads actually looked like, but she convinced me that they were her favorite hot pads, and she used them when she could. They were, you know, obviously the strangest shape ever. Eventually, I did enter into scarf-ness, and Granny was kind enough to keep that scarf and say that it was her favorite scarf. And in retrospect, I'm thinking it's because it was so funny looking that she knew I would be laughed at if I took it home. But there it was. Innocence was expressing itself through this grandmother teaching this grandbaby how to enter into a very ancient archetype and how to knit. There was cooking and gardening and having tea parties with neighbors and taking walks into town, but knitting was the gift that she gave me that lasted to this day. And knitting is what keeps innocence alive in me. This segment is what we call the politics of ethical behavior. And you know, last time we talked about the fact that the word politics means appropriate behavior, what is judicious in the moment. It's not about Democrat versus Republican or bipartisan, whatever that word used to mean. So I want to talk to you today about the science of innocence, about how science is beginning to catch up with the idea of spiritual principles, innocence being one of them. I listened recently to an interview that Deepak Chopra did with Mikio Kaku. I think that is the way he pronounces his name. He's the scientist that created the string theory, and he's recently written a new book called The Physics of the Impossible. And he talks about some of the things that he lists as presently impossible: invisibility, teleporting, time travel, and visiting multiple dimensions. But he claims that these are not always going to be impossible. In fact, in the near future, some of these things will be possible. We're going to figure out how to accomplish the impossible in the perceptual reality that we live in. Now, an innocent, someone who has innocence in their invisible garment, can certainly believe this. Kaku talks about his fish story. He talks about how he used to go to restaurants with his mom and dad, and he would sit out by the koi pond and he would look at the fish. And he knew just enough about fish to know that they only see two-dimensionally. So here they are in their world of water and lily pods and whatever their world is down there. And here is his face just above the water looking at them, but they can't see him. They can't see into this dimension. They may not even be able to imagine this dimension. And in fact, if he were to reach down in there and pull one of them out, he would probably die in this dimension. He needs the water dimension to live in. So Kaku's string theory says that there are at least 11 or 12 dimensions that are parallel with each other. We live in three of them. We can vaguely be aware of another one or two if we become aware of the time, space, you know, kind of thing. And we can dream another one or two. We can dream that we can fly, and we can dream that we do teleport and time travel in our dreams. But all 11 or 12 of them, we can't even imagine yet. However, he says that the connecting thread, the string that connects all of the dimensions, is music. Isn't that interesting? So just be aware that when you dream music, when there is music in your dreams, you have probably actually connected to one of the 10, 11, 12 dimensions that we can't access. This cosmic music is the connection between all dimensions. Which reminds me that recently I had a dream, and in this dream I was moved to the 11th floor of the dormitory where I was in graduate school. And this key that I had, they gave me a key to my new dorm room, and it opened all of the doors on the floor. And finally somebody said to me, "Oh yeah, on this level you only need one key. One key opens all of the doors." So when I was listening to this interview with Kaku, I was thinking, oh, maybe that dream was more about a musical key than it was about a, you know, metal thing that opens a lock. The appropriate musical key in the symphony that is your life is what allows you to teleport and become invisible and visit new dimensions outside your pond. This is what is interesting to me, that we can learn to visit multiple dimensions, that we can expand our minds, that when we learn to behave in this reality and in these dimensions according to a unified field of behavior that is appropriate in all dimensions, then all of these silly political arguments that we're having about how to take care of each other, or whether to take care of each other, or whether to let people die or go bankrupt or whatever it is that we're talking about, none of that's going to matter anymore when we begin to expand ourselves into these multiple dimensions. And so also back to innocence in the heart. The electromagnetic field around the heart is what's interesting about this new brain. These heart fields become these radiant brains that send information out, bring information back, and keep innocence alive in our system. We are constantly able to continue to learn because we've got the one key that allows us to share information freely with everyone and with everything around us. And this is the politics of behavior. Learning to behave according to the one key that opens all the doors. My friend Cami Dadi has written a beautiful little essay about innocence that I just wanted to share with you today. One of the greatest gifts innocence has offered me is an unreserved and wholehearted willingness to learn something new. I live in a university town where lots of learning goes on, in a community of many very smart and highly educated people where everyone is an authority on something, or at least wants to be. Unfortunately, one of the disadvantages to all this smartness is that no one ever wants to be seen as not knowing. But lucky for me, I had come to accept my innocence before I moved here. So not only is it okay for me to not know, it's okay with me if you don't know, too. Innocence moves me to ask, how can I help you find out? Turns out that this is a useful attitude to have working in a library as I do. Innocence, as a primary giving in my life, has driven me right back to school. Getting a degree in library and information science at age 56, so I can keep on helping other people find out what they want to know. It is innocence that gives me the answer to the question, am I too old to learn something new? This happy learner attitude is sometimes hard for others to understand. People think I'm a bit naive and wonder how I could possibly allow myself to be a beginner again, how I could not realize that who I am is what I know, and just how much time do I think I have left in life anyway. Sometimes I let myself be bedeviled by these questions too. As a culture, we tend to glorify innocence in the young. She's so curious. She asks so many questions. They just love learning. Though we expect adults to grow up and out of it. But we deprive others of more than just the right to ask questions when we ask them to put on the oh-so-tight-fitting expert suit. Because a funny thing, an amazing, miraculous thing happens at some point when we stop trying to control innocence and let it take us where it will instead. The desire to truly see begins to beckon us, and the desire to judge anyone or anything dissipates. The wish to learn, the will to know, leads us, quite without our realizing it, eventually to truth. What else is there to know, really? And what is truth? Only God is truth, and God is love. So this is where innocence leads us, back to its birthplace, straight home to the heart of God. I can't begin to tell you how surprised I am. About innocence or your invisible garment, including the colors of your strands, and about dreaming as a spiritual practice, go to www.turtledreamers.com. There you go.